This is HeartWise, offering practical tips and time-proven guidelines to make your life healthier, happier, and more fulfilling. Today you'll learn simple Bible-based principles for building and maintaining optimum mental and physical health, all while deepening your relationship with your Creator. I'm your HeartWise host, Charles Mills. To exam or not to exam? That is the question when it comes to breast cancer. Our guest today says for women, mammograms and even self-exams may not be the best idea. Why? Let's ask him. Dr. Michael Greger is a physician and founding member of the American College of Lifestyle Medicine. He's a best-selling author, much sought-after speaker, and the driving force behind the extremely popular and highly informative website, nutritionfacts.org. He's also a frequent guest on this program, and we're so glad he's willing to accommodate us. Dr. Greger, welcome back to HeartWise.
Happy to be back.
Now, you and your team read all, and I mean all, of the English language clinical reports concerning nutrition that exists on this earth. Then you present the data on your website in short, easy-to-understand videos and blogs. You recently spent a lot of time on the subject of breast cancer and, more specifically, mammograms. Why all the fuss, Dr. Greger? Every woman needs these examinations, right?
Sometimes cancer screening can lead to important benefits, but it can also lead to important harm. So it's always important to, you know, as with anything, particularly in medicine, you have to make sure that the benefits outweigh the risks. Cancer screening test that's been most carefully studied is mammograms. The last 50 years, more than 600,000 women have participated in 10 randomized trials, and given that extraordinary research effort, it's ironic that mammograms continue to be one of the most contentious issues within the medical community. There are a few things in medicine that bring up more kind of heated debate. And so I think that contentiousness is itself instructive than the fact that there's also, you know, multi-billion dollar industries at stake.
Right.
I realize that it's difficult to kind of get at the truth.
Yeah.
What we end up is a number of contradictory cancer screening recommendations, with some institutions saying mammograms starting at age 40, others say 50, some say every year, some say every other year, and some say women shouldn't get them at all.
Mm.
And it turns out that, yeah, I mean, you'd think women are so bombarded with information about mammograms, you'd think they'd be fairly knowledgeable about them, but nothing's really farther than the truth. 9 out of 10 women surveyed vastly overestimated the benefits or have no idea. I mean, it's obviously not their fault. They've just been misinformed by the system. Most American women didn't even appear to understand the basic concept of screening, thinking mammograms somehow help prevent you from getting breast cancer in the first place, which is, of course, you know, nonsense.
Now, of course, you also make it clear in your presentations here that women are not the only ones who don't fully understand mammograms and their pluses and minuses. Am I right?
Yeah. So, yeah, doctors, because of the money involved,
yes.
The doctors themselves are often very confused. That's why we rely on, for example, the USPSTF, the United Services Preventive Task Force, which is kind of this non-governmental body of the top research experts that are trying to come out with some kind of objective recommendations. And they have kept pulling back, recommending fewer and fewer mammograms. And I think basically we end up saying that really it's up to each individual woman. There absolutely are benefits. There absolutely are harms. And so it's just a matter of women making up their own minds, informing themselves and making up their own minds. It's their body, their choice, in terms of whether or not they think the benefits outweigh the risk for themselves.
Okay, now here we have some women listening to this program, and their doctors haven't told them what you're about to say, and they haven't heard it on the news, what you're about to say, but they're about to hear it here. So, Dr. Greger, I want to have you talk to those members of my audience right now, women, who are thinking, who have been told that mammograms are the way to go and that they need to get involved with this program or they're putting themselves at danger. What do you say to that group?
You have to become informed. So basically, I have about a dozen, for maybe 14 video series.
Yeah.
So far, half of them are up on the website already. The other half will be out in the next few days. Mm-hmm. So they're all free. People should learn about the benefits and risks. And so, I mean, even the concept of risks for cancer screening, I think, is kind of foreign to people. The most common risks are false positives, pain during the procedure, radiation exposure. But the most serious downside is now recognized to be something called overdiagnosis. So serious, in fact, that that's what has raised the question, does that make the whole thing worthless overall for the average woman? And so that's why the value of doing routine mammograms have been called into question, is due to overdiagnosis. And what that is the diagnosis and treatment of breast cancer that would never have become a threat to woman's health or even a parent during her lifetime. And I think people think that once you have a cancer cell in your body, people think that it just will predictively and inevitably, you know, kind of lead to some terrible death. But that's not true for most cancers. You know, some cancers, you know, they outgrow their blood supply, become starved, wither away. Others are recognized by our immune system, it's successfully contained. And some are just never that aggressive in the first place, meaning that, yeah, if they were able to grow unchecked, you know, maybe in 200 years or something, they'd be big enough to cause problems or even become noticed. But, you know, many of us don't think we're going to live quite that long.
Right.
And so many people die essentially with their tumors as opposed to from their tumors. So if you do autopsy studies of young middle-aged women that just happen to die in a car accident or something, about 1 in 5, 20% have cancer in their breast. So like 1 in 5 women are walking around with breast cancer. Now that sounds a lot scarier than it is, since at that age range, you know, the risk of dying from breast cancer is less than 1%. In fact, your risk of ever dying from breast cancer in your lifetime is less than 4%.
Wow.
Which goes to show how many of these cancers were they found incidentally on autopsy. Most of them would have just fizzled out on their own. And so that is the concern with diagnosis. If one of those tumors that would have fizzled out on their own, never become known to the woman, never cause any problems, never cause any symptoms, if they were picked up on mammograms, biopsied, they'd see it was indeed cancer, and then they would treat it as it were cancer, understandably, because you never know if it's going to be a non-aggressive type or an aggressive type. And so then this woman may undergo surgery, radiation, chemotherapy, and may, in fact, suffer or die because of that therapy.
Wow.
Just the radiation to the chest can so increase the risk of heart disease risk and scarring in the lungs. And right, I mean, and so you would accept those risks for the benefits of not dying from breast cancer. But if it's one of those tumors, in fact, the majority of those tumors that would never have caused problems in the first place, that is where we're left with this overdiagnosis problem. And so that really has to kind of play into one's decision making as to whether or not one wants to undergo the procedure.
Now, you've looked at a lot of studies and you quote them in your videos here. Let me ask you this question. A woman 50 years old goes and has a mammogram and one of those suspected cancers are found and she goes through all these treatments you're talking about. Another woman doesn't go and have that treatment, has the very same cancer in her breast. Is the one going through all the treatments going to live longer and have a better chance of seeing her great-grandchildren than the one who doesn't have the treatment if it's the same kind of cancer and that cancer is not deadly?
None of the studies have ever shown a total mortality benefit, meaning no study has ever shown that women are actually able to live longer on average, being randomized to mammograms or not getting mammograms. So, I mean, you could say that's, you know, billions of dollars wasted for nothing. And you say, well, how is that possible? Because it does been shown to decrease deaths from breast cancer. So the only way that you don't get any net benefit at all overall is if somehow it increases your risk on the other side. And indeed, so routine mammograms would increase a 50-year-old non-smoking woman's overall survival chance perhaps from 96 to 97% over 10 years, something like that. But that disregards deaths from overdiagnosis. So deaths from the unnecessary radiation and chemo, increased mortality from heart disease and other cancers that may entirely outweigh the benefit of the reduced breast cancer mortality. So how it comes out, kind of based on best and worst case scenario estimates, for every 10,000 women invited for 10 years of mammogram screening, 3 to 4 breast cancer deaths may be avoided at the cost of around 2 to 9 deaths from the long-term toxicity of unnecessary radiation treatments. Yet, you know, only about 1 in 10 women undergoing mammography said they were ever told about the whole concept of overdiagnosis, even though 9 out of 10 thought they had the right to know.
My. Dr. Michael Greger is our guest today. Before we go to break, let me ask you this final question on this subject, and that is, what should we do? I mean, is there a way for us to protect ourselves from breast cancer in the first place? And even if we have it, are there treatments that you know about that may have something to do with nutrition that can help us overcome what's happening in our bodies without having to go through all the other stuff that can kill us?
That's really where the emphasis should be placed is not catching the cancer early, but preventing the cancer from appearing in the first place, right?
Yes.
And the way we do that is through a healthy diet and lifestyle. And so that means abstinence from alcohol. That means not becoming overweight and obese. That means lots of fruits and vegetables, low red meat and dairy intake. And so, I mean, that's really the most important thing. There are some cancer screening techniques that have been shown to actually extend lifespan. So, for example, pap smear, cervical cancer screening, has been found to actually improve lifespan. Colon cancer screening, like sigmoidoscopies, have been shown to actually improve lifespan. But unfortunately, mammography is not one of those tests.
All right. Dr. Michael Greger from NutritionFacts.org, his book, How Not to Die, New York Times bestseller, for a reason that you'll know the minute you pick that book up and start reading it. And all that information is available for you at NutritionFacts.org. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, more from Dr. Greger. I want to talk about nutritional yeast, medical marijuana, and cell phones as it relates to sperm count. Stay right where you are.
I'm Dr. James Markham with your Biblical Prescription for Life. I had a question come into the website. I cannot sleep at night. I have a lot of fear and anxiety. Well, our Biblical Prescription for Life is 2 Timothy 1, verses 7. For God has not given us the spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of sound mind. Dr. Cohen at the University of Missouri has shown that people that have a spiritual life have great health benefits. Well, one of the health benefits is it lowers a chemical called adrenaline. Adrenaline's a chemical that keeps us going when we're stressed, but it also can keep us awake at night. Well, claim this gift and believe that God will give this to us, and this will lower our adrenaline levels, helping us to rest better at night. Give it a try today. Walk in a relationship with Him. For more information, go to our website, heartwiseministries.org.
Welcome back to the program. I'm your host, Charles Mills. Our guest today, Dr. Michael Greger, the driving force of NutritionFacts.org. We had a fantastic conversation before the break on mammographies and their pluses and their minuses, and you'd be surprised if you want to hear this program again. Of course, you can go to heartwiseministries.org, listening to the radio section, and you can hear this program and share it with other people. I recommend you do that as well. Or you can go to nutritionfacts.org, and you can hear Dr. Greger talk about the studies he mentioned in this conversation. Okay, we move now into fighting cancer in other ways, and one of those ways is the use of something you may have in your kitchen, nutritional yeast. Tell us about this, Dr. Greger.
Yeah, so we've known for hundreds of years that there are cases of spontaneous regression of inoperable cancers following various infections. And the thought is that the infection may so rile up the immune system that cancer kind of gets caught in the crossfire. I mean, this is something that the ancient Egyptians thousands of years ago were writing about in their hieroglyphics. We didn't know, though, until it started to put to the test, formally studied in the 1800s, where doctors actually started intentionally infecting cancer patients, most famous of which was this guy, William Cawley, who started out at what would become Memorial Sloan Kettering. So he was convinced that severe infection could cause cancer to regress. So we started infecting cancer patients with things like malaria. Sure. And the problem is that many of his cancer patients died of the infection. And so the question is, well, wait a second, is there some way we can boost the immune system without actually killing the patient?
That would be a good thing. Yes.
That would indeed be a good thing. And there are, in fact, these therapeutic cancer vaccines, one of which has been used for decades. People don't realize this. There's actually, for people with bladder cancer, what they do is they take this weakened bovine tuberculosis bacteria and they stick it in a tube up into your bladder, and that irritates the bladder wall, causes the immune system to attack, and boost long-term survival up to 36% for bladder cancer, because while your immune system is attacking that weakened cow tuberculosis, it's also attacking the cancer cells, which it also recognizes for them. So this whole concept has been used for decades, and the question is, can we use it for other cancers as well? Is there a way to tip off the immune system without increasing our risk of infection? And so attention has moved to these compounds in yeast called beta-glucans, where our body, our immune system, recognizes these proteins because they're made by pathogenic fungus as well. So since the times of antiquity, our body is very good at recognizing the signs of fungal infection. But some fungus, like mushrooms and, you know, baker's yeast and nutritional yeast, have these same kind of proteins, but of course are non-pathogenic, don't cause disease. So the question is, well, maybe we can kind of fool the immune system into mounting an attack to kind of, you know, to turn on the red alert, but by giving something that doesn't cause any problems. So there was a double-blind randomized placebo-controlled trial of breast cancer patients with these so-called beta-glucans, which are these special type of fiber found in nutritional yeast. It was found to significantly improve wound healing, but unfortunately they didn't carry out the study long enough to actually look at cancer outcomes. So all we have is this Japanese literature. So there's 20 randomized controlled trials published in, unfortunately, in Japanese, but there are some English translations of some of the reviews that do seem to show, on balance, a positive effect on survival and quality of life. So, for example, there was a study, and again, I wasn't able to show this study directly just because I don't read Japanese, but this was the review article that talked about it. They took some this yeast beta glucan to prevent cancer relapse after surgery. No relapses in the treated group, about 1 in 5 in the control group. Even inoperable cancer patients, end-stage cancer, there was a study that showed that only about 1 in 20 patients made it out 3 months, and by 6 months they were all dead. But in the treated group, where they were just given basically a pinch of nutritional yeast every day, then the majority survived for more than 3 months. Not 1 in 20, but most, and 43% were still alive at 6 months out, as opposed to none. And so that's really quite extraordinary. And that's a single pinch of nutritional yeast a day that would cost less than a penny, and the only side effect is like tastier popcorn. So I encourage people to give it a try.
I also put it on your salads. That's where I put mine too, and it's delicious.
That's a good. Oh, anything that gets you to eat more salad is by definition healthy.
Dr. Greger, what are your thoughts on medical marijuana? You talked about this several times on several of your videos. Is it habit forming? Does it actually help? What do we need to know about medical marijuana?
My most recent video was about whether or not marijuana is addictive or not.
Right.
And the evidence clearly indicates that long-term marijuana use can indeed lead to addiction. Approximately 9% of those who experiment with marijuana will become addicted. That's about a move that bumps up to about 1 in 6 of those who start using marijuana as teenagers, and up to 25 to 50% of those who smoke marijuana on a daily basis. So what we're talking about is an acquired chronic relapsing disorder characterized by this powerful motivation to continue to engage in the behavior despite persistent negative consequences. You want to stop, but when you try, you suffer withdrawal symptoms, which can make it hard to quit. So this withdrawal syndrome with marijuana typically begins 1 to 2 days after stopping, peaks at about 2 to 6 days. Cravings, sleep problems, nightmares, anger, irritability, unease, nausea, though it does go away within 1 to 2 weeks. So I encourage people who are trying to stop to stick it out, and within 1 to 2 weeks, they should be better. Now, having said that, certainly less addictive than many other drugs, legal drugs like alcohol.
Yes.
Only about half the dependence risk compared to, you know, heroin or cocaine. Less than a third is habit-forming as tobacco. But, you know, look, about 20 million Americans actively use the stuff. So we're talking about a lot of people here. People don't realize, you know, when many people realize, you know, who may now think back, they might have experimented back in the 60s or 70s, this is not your grandmother's marijuana. We're talking the potency has tripled in recent years. It used to only be about 4% THC, which is kind of the active compound. Now up to average of 12%. Denver, California, up to about 15%. Seattle's pushing 20%. Up to like 15 times more powerful than pot from the 70s. So that's like 15 joints rolled up into one.
Right.
And so if you're thinking, well, wait a second, you know, I experiment with this stuff, I didn't become addicted, you may be talking about the more kind of natural varieties before they were selectively bred for increasing levels. And this helps explain why we see such a increase in emergency room visits for marijuana intoxication in Colorado, for example, after legalization. So it's kind of like, you know, tobacco industry. They were intentionally boosting nicotine levels in their products to make them more addictive. But that's where the analogy really breaks down. It's the consequences of the addiction. Every year, tobacco kills 25 times more people worldwide than all illicit drugs combined. Alcohol kills 10 times more people than all illicit drugs combined, right? So you see, you know, these cannabis advocates saying, look, you know, tobacco, alcohol are worse in terms of mortality, morbidity, disease, and death. And that's true, but, I mean, when you have to hold up those as your product, anything looks healthy compared to those, that doesn't mean that it can't cause harm.
Dr. Greger, we just have about 90 seconds left in the program, and I want to touch on this. Gentlemen, if you are having a little hard time reproducing, it may be because of your cell phone and laptop. Dr. Greger, explain that. 90 seconds.
No, absolutely. So they actually, if you take basically sperm in a petri dish and you stick a laptop with Wi-Fi attached, you can actually see an impairment in basically the healthfulness of the sperm. And so using a laptop in the way that its name implies on your lap is not necessarily a good thing for two reasons. One, because of the warmth,
yes.
Actually the heat itself, but then the Wi-Fi separate from the temperature may actually impair the sperm. Now, it just cuts like the number of swimming sperm by about 10%. And look, you know, fertile men release hundreds of millions. But if you are on that edge of you have problems conceiving, and so you already have some issue, then certainly you don't want to be sticking your cell phone in your pocket or your laptop in your lap.
All right, cell phone in your pocket, laptop on your lap. Not a good idea if you are on that edge and you need all the sperm you can get. That's words of wisdom from our guest today, Dr. Michael Greger. NutritionFacts.org is the website to hear many more pieces of information like this. It's all right there waiting for you. His book, How Not to Die, is also featured there as well. NutritionFacts.org. Dr. Greger, always a pleasure to have you with us today. Thank you so much for giving us these words of wisdom and guidance. Thank you.
Looking forward to next time.
And until next time, this is Charles Mills along with Dr. Michael Greger inviting you to remain heartwise. Goodbye, everyone. Thank you for joining us today on HeartWise. If you'd like more information on how to build and maintain optimum physical, mental, and spiritual health, log on to heartwiseministries.org. HeartWise is a listener-supported program, and your partnership with us would be greatly appreciated. Once again, our web address is heartwiseministries.org.